Hello, and welcome to another episode of Boundless Body Radio. I'm your host, Casey Ruff, and today we have another amazing guest introduced to you now. Audrey Wells, MD, attended the University of Michigan Medical School and went on to train at Washington University School of Medicine in pediatrics and pediatric pulmonary medicine. It was during this time that she discovered a specific interest in adult and pediatric sleep medicine. She also led the development of Omni Sleep Medicine Centers in New Mexico to become a comprehensive sleep clinic for both adults and children from 2010 until 2018. She has also completed an obesity medicine fellowship at Columbia University and now holds 3 board certifications in pediatrics, sleep medicine, and obesity medicine. In 2021, she founded SuperSleep MD, an online platform for education, support, and group coaching experiences specifically for people struggling with obstructive sleep apnea treatments. Through SuperSleep MD, she offers a comprehensive library of self-directed courses, a group coaching program, and a private Facebook community. Dr. Wells also has an individual consultation program for physicians and everyday people who want to optimize their sleep to improve performance, vitality, and well-being. You can find Dr. Audrey Wells on her website at www.supersleepmd.com and also at awellsmd.com for individual consultations for high achievers. Dr. Audrey Wells, what an absolute honor it is to welcome you to Boundless Body Radio.
Thanks, Casey. It's great to be here. And thanks for that kind introduction.
It was amazing. You've done a lot of things and you've been a lot of places in the world. So well-deserved, a very nice introduction. It's interesting to talk about something that is so universally wanted by everybody, yet we always seem to sabotage ourselves when we try to get more of that certain thing. It seems like, you know, 9 p.m. Casey really just wants to, you know, watch another episode of Drive to Survive on Netflix when I know I need to be winding down. And the morning Casey always takes 9 p.m. Casey, and we just have this battle going back and forth. It's kind of weird to talk about something that all of us never get enough of. We always want more, and yet we seem to sabotage ourselves and never get what we want.
That's so true. And to your point, your brain in the evening, when it comes time to make that decision to go to bed or do something else, is different than the brain that you're operating with in the morning. So it makes sense that there would be that internal conflict happening. It's something I see a lot.
Well, I definitely want to talk about your own personal story and how you got interested in this. And I love hearing you on other podcasts talk about practical tips and things that can help people. But before we go there, I actually want to talk about a recent event. You actually just hosted a sleep summit, which sounded amazing. I didn't know at first that it was a virtual thing. So I just figured you found some like windowless, you know, warehouse and put a bunch of mattresses in there and people could just like leave their phones at the door and just sleep for a whole week or something. But it was virtual. So tell me how the summit went. What was the format and what would you consider it a success? Excuse me.
Yeah, definitely. It was an online summit, which is super convenient for not only people in my time zone, but others in the United States and even across the globe. We had a massive response. So I can tell you that there's definitely a hunger out there for sleep, for practical guidance in how to get better sleep, how to prioritize sleep, and also what sort of health conditions, not only physical health, but mental health, poor sleep impacts. So I interviewed 50 people who are experts in the field or tangential fields. And it was just really a labor of love. This is my passion. And it's something that I feel that everyone deserves to experience, that pleasure from natural sleep. And sometimes it's just a matter of overcoming some obstacles. Sometimes it's getting out of your own way to get to that place where you're getting restful, deep sleep.
Wow. Okay. So 50 interviews. I limit myself to do one of these interviews a day. And I feel like I try to prepare as much as I can. How did you prepare to do 50 interviews?
Oh my goodness. So I would say, yes, it was a lot of work, but it sort of energized me the whole time. And this, I did the interviews over a couple, 3 months. And then fortunately, the production team was able to take all of that information in order to produce the summit. I had a hand in kind of organizing the interviews so that every day of the 7-day summit, people were getting a taste of insomnia treatment, a taste of sleep apnea, weight loss and obesity care, heart disease, diabetes, all of the things that impact health and that can be up-leveled when you improve your sleep.
Yeah, very interesting. So I found you as you were a guest on the Stay Off My Operating Table with Dr. Jack Heald. Dr. Philip Ovedia and Jack Heald both have been hosted on our show as well. And so I'm used to them being in more of the space that I'm in, which is kind of low carbohydrate nutrition. A lot of our audience is into that. And you know, I just got back from a conference this weekend where that was the topic. And if Philip Ovedia had showed up and gave a speech, I would just kind of nod along with everybody else and say like, yeah, I'm expecting this. This fits my confirmation bias and my ideas about nutrition quite well. So I'm curious to know, I know he spoke in your summit. I'm curious to know what he spoke about and how that was received by people that may or may not already be into that kind of space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think first of all, it's insightful for you to realize that there's this idea of confirmation bias that exists. And for sure, there's marketing efforts meant to tickle that bone for each of us. And I think people kind of dig into that, especially when they're scrolling at night or engaging with social media. So all of this can kind of feed the idea that we are absolutely right and there's no other way to do things. And I love constantly reminding people to make some space for different ideas and opinions. Because doing that not only leaves room for your own personal growth, but also helps us to build reliable and enjoyable relationships with others. I mean, that's one of the things we're meant to do when we go through life is to have that community and positive relationship with others. Dr. Ovedia spoke about sleep and its effects on metabolism. And what he is promoting is a low carbohydrate, largely animal protein-based diet. And that is one way to go about your nutrition and weight loss and weight maintenance. I can tell you that when I went through my obesity medicine training, I was kind of excited at the beginning, like, oh, I'm going to finally figure out what it is that can help people lose weight with the idea that there's a right way to do it. And what I learned was that there's actually many right ways to do it, probably as many right ways as there are people in the world. And you kind of have to figure out what works for you. But the exciting thing is that something can work for you. And I think that, you know, with Dr. Ovedia's team and his followers, they are subscribed to this idea because they're seeing results from it. There are other ways to approach your nutrition. And one of the benefits of having a discussion with someone like him was highlighting how sleep and nutrition have a bi-directional relationship, and they're both part of some of the foundational principles of health. So it was really fun to have that discussion and kind of ping pong on our experiences, not only for the followers that we have, but also from a sleep medicine point of view and a cardiovascular disease point of view.
Yeah, I love that. It is so frustrating to be in this field and make that realization that once you think you know something that might be true for you or a few people you know, it's not true for everybody. People have different, you know, biases and different opinions and different things they like or don't like. Like, all of that has to be taken into account. And I love the way that you mentioned that kind of bi-directional change. I mean, we work primarily with people on their nutrition, whatever direction they want to go. And I see sleep improvements all the time. And you kind of do it both ways. You can work with nutrition or just work on somebody's sleep habits and you see all the other things get better. So it's cool that kind of loop, the same loop that goes downward negatively really quick when your sleep sucks and then your sugar cravings go up and then, you know, you're staying up way too late and then you're wired and tired, like that downward spiral, you can actually like reverse it, have a positive spiral, a benefit, and one benefit gives you two other benefits and so on and so forth. It's kind of cool.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, really, with just a little bit of intervention and cognitive restructuring, you can really get into a place where you're using your nutrition and your sleep to amplify your health. And I think that's something that's so exciting, but people who've struggled with that for a long time tend to be in a place where they feel very stuck and even hopeless.
Totally. I totally understand that. When we see all the comorbidities that come along with sleep disorders, the depression and anxiety is up there with some of the biggest ones. We know how that affects our mental health. But let's talk about your history and how you got interested in sleep. You were practicing something totally different. And all of a sudden, this subject kind of looks like kind of grabbed you. Can you tell us about how this became of interest to you?
Yeah. I'll start off by saying that, I really took a deep dive into sleep when I started bumping up against my own personal limitations with sleep deprivation. So I was doing a pediatric pulmonary fellowship, which was very heavily based in the ICU, so the intensive care unit. I was taking care of kids who had lung transplants, different types of pulmonary disorders. Cystic fibrosis was a big one. And, you know, in the ICU, it's very demanding. You end up kind of sacrificing personal time and just trying to stay up on top of your basic human needs in the off hours. But the truth was, I was not tolerating the overnight call, the shifts in overnight in the hospital. You know, I felt that I wasn't as sharp as I wanted to be mentally. And even though I could physically do it, when I looked at year on year on year of this as a career, it started to become clear to me that it wasn't going to be sustainable. It was against my grain, if you will. And I remember I was at a big pulmonary conference, and I was the ironic thing was I was in this full day seminar, falling asleep at like 10 o'clock in the morning. And in order to wake myself up, I just got up and I started walking the hall, and I came across another day-long seminar about sleep. And I read the information that was posted outside, and I felt this pull inside me. I felt interested in these topics. I felt like I could get behind them in a way that was really consistent with my values. I was like, really, it was a revelation for me. And so I kind of bookmarked that. And then later, when I had the opportunity to do a sleep medicine fellowship, I pounced on it. And I haven't looked back since.
Wow. Very cool. If you wouldn't mind, wax poetic a little bit about sleep itself. I think a lot of people out there think of sleep as an inconvenience. It's not that important. You're just kind of turning everything off. Tell us a little bit about why we need sleep, what goes on during our sleep, and why it's so important for us.
This is a really foundational question. So in my experience, people will negotiate with themselves over sleep. Sleep is something that can be put on the back burner. There's this adage, you know, I'll sleep when I'm dead, or sleep is for the weak. People stay up later on the weekdays and then try to catch up on the weekends. And you know, they pinch their sleep on either end, sometimes just because they're looking for some me time, which is otherwise scarce. So there's a number of different reasons why people would reduce the sleep or put it down low on their priority list. But the thing about sleep is for your brain. And your brain is the most important asset you have, full stop. Without your brain being fully online, you can't perform your job as well. You don't lay down memories as well. You're more irritable and less patient in your relationships. You basically trade your sleep for what is functioning as your most important asset. And I think when people really kind of start losing sleep chronically and not being able to cope with that and make up for it, they get a glimpse of that. But even folks who are getting less than 7 hours of sleep per night on a consistent basis are not living up to their full potential. And so for anyone who's interested in really maximizing their quality of life, maximizing their well-being and their longevity as they age, you want to age into health, not disease. Sleep is one of the best things you can do to ensure that that's happening.
Yeah, very well explained. And we're going to talk about some of the more severe kind of conditions that come with disordered sleeping. But what are some of the earliest warning signs? I feel like this is probably a little obvious, but maybe you'll have some insights into some things that were maybe a little bit less obvious. But as you're seeing disordered sleep patterns develop, what are some of the very, very early signs that, like, you probably should address this now before this becomes more serious down the road?
Yeah. You know, I want to dialogue a little bit with you about this. Are you open to that?
Absolutely.
So I wonder if you can recall the last bad night of sleep that you had.
Yes. As we're recording this, we are not too far away from the time change that we just had mm-hmm. in my state. Some states don't have it. We had it. And it's the crappy one. It's the spring forward one. So you lose an hour of sleep. And I just traveled to a conference and my time changed by an hour. And that didn't seem to bother me as much as every single year. It really bothers me when the time changes. And it seems to bother all of my clients as well. Everybody seems like they're just a little bit more zombie-like. So within the last week or so, I've had a few nights of sleep that just were not quite as good, not quite as deep.
Yeah. And what did that kick up for you? I'm talking about your daytime experience, your functioning, your motivation, your decision-making, or maybe just like at night, laying in bed frustrated. What happened for you?
Great question. I love this. For me, it's lighter later. And so for me, I tend to stay up a little bit longer than I like. I've heard you talk about this before. I think I'm more of a lark kind of sleep personality or whatever you call that, where I like to rise early. I'm normally up naturally by about 5 p.m. To do that, I've got my kind of routine that I do before I go to bed. And I like to get that going around like, 7:30 by 8:30. I'm kind of like really winding down and I don't stay up often past 9, but it was just easier again to binge another episode on Netflix or not get my, blue light glasses on because it's, still just a little bit light outside. And so when the alarm comes on, which normally I don't need, I would set it just to be safe and it would come on and I would just be like, oh my goodness, like, yeah, that was a really short night of sleep. And then during the day, I do feel, I would say probably brain fog would be the most consistent one, where it's a little bit harder to remember things. I'm not quite as sharp. It's not the worst thing in the world. It's not as optimized.
Yeah. Yeah. And what you're describing is such a universal human experience. And this is something that I like to highlight to people. I've heard this story so many times, and I use it to kind of bring people together because nobody is sort of excluded from the effects of poor sleep. No matter where you are in life, how old you are, how much money you make or don't make, how smart you are or aren't, nobody doesn't get out of short sleep without some effects. Now, you mentioned brain fog, and this is a really common term. It's like you just know that you're not finding the words like you normally do, or you're not as tolerant of, plans changing, or your problem solving is just a little bit off because your brain kind of feels slow and muddy. And this is one of the earlier effects of sleep deprivation. The part of your brain that is kind of doing these higher order thought processes is the cortex, the neocortex that's really on the outside of your brain, behind your forehead and such. And that's the newest part of our brain that is most susceptible to the effects of sleep deprivation. Let me tell you something else that happens. Normally, your cortex inhibits your emotional center, which is right at the middle of your brain. So I kind of have my thumb inside my fist. My thumb represents my emotional brain, and my four fingers wrapped around it are the new part of the brain. And normally there is inhibition of the emotional brain so that we aren't so reactive. We have impulse control. We have the ability to kind of pull ourselves up by our bootstraps and say, okay, it's really late in the day, but just another hour and then I'm going to clock out. That kind of positive reinforcement that is so available to us when we are well slept. Now, at the end of the day, our frontal lobes start to expire and they get leaky, and out comes our emotional brain wanting to say, watch more Netflix, go make some popcorn, eat all the candy, be irritable with your spouse. Because now we have lost that inhibition and our emotional brain is like a prehistoric toddler cave baby that wants all the things, So I think just being aware of that can give you an idea of what some short-term sleep symptoms look like. But over the long term, what I really think happens a lot of times is people just have these slow changes and they're constantly establishing a new normal. And then they look up 5 years later and they're like, this isn't the person that I want to be. This isn't what I thought for myself. I feel like I'm older than I actually am. And sometimes that's actually attributed to aging. And I'm always reluctant to buy into that. I always want to say attributing your symptoms to age is like a last resort approach. You really want to look at your foundation, your sleep, first of all, your nutrition, and your exercise. If those are teed up and doing well, then you will likely feel better and mentally be better as well.
That's a great answer. I love that. Okay, so as we're going down that path, unfortunately, let's choose somebody who is experiencing that brain fog. They're waking up, they're over-caffeinating themselves, they can power through and get through that. Let's take that down the road to some of the more severe kind of sleep disorders that you come across and have to deal with, namely sleep apnea. That's got to be the big one. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sleep apnea is a scary sleep disorder. And, you know, for anyone listening, I think there's this temptation to kind of brush it under the rug because you don't want to hear it. You don't want to hear that sleep apnea may be a possibility. And often it's because people have it in their minds that if they go get their sleep tested, there's going to be a CPAP machine waiting for them at the end of the night, and it's going to make its home on their bedside table, and they're going to be strangled by it for the rest of their lives. And I want to tell everyone listening to this program that that's not the case. I feel very strongly that people have choices when it comes to managing their sleep apnea or not. But to kind of stick your head in the sand and decide that you're not even going to go the route of getting tested is not doing you any favors at all. So if there's even a whiff of chance that somebody could have sleep apnea, it is worthwhile to look at that because it's otherwise a blind spot in your life. Now, before I get ahead of myself, I want to just point out what happens when you have sleep apnea. Sleep apnea is a breathing problem that happens during sleep. Now, what occurs is when you fall asleep, all the muscles in your body relax, and that includes the muscles in the back of your throat. Now, that's even in normal people without sleep apnea that happens, but for people who have sleep apnea, that muscle relaxation causes the throat tissues to come together and interfere with air getting from outside in the room down to your lungs. So you have drops in your blood oxygen level. And when your brain is oxygen deprived, it will have to interrupt its sleep to gasp and take some recovery breaths. Snoring may or may not be a part in this. Now, the presence of snoring is useful. The absence of snoring doesn't mean anything to me, okay? Now, let me just tell you, Casey, if someone were to say, okay, I have these pauses in breathing, my oxygen levels go down, and my brain gets interrupted, and this is happening during the daytime, they'd be running to the emergency room because that's not normal. Why do we tolerate it in our sleep? We tolerate it in our sleep because we are unconscious during sleep. The person who's affected is not available to observe that. And so you kind of just manage it in a way. You tolerate the sleep disruption. You tolerate the brain fog. You tolerate just feeling tired all the time, which is a real drag. So I want to just point out that sleep apnea is common, okay? About one in every three adult men have at least mild sleep apnea, potentially severe, and at least one in every five adult women have mild sleep apnea, potentially moderate or severe. So this is a common condition, and it's one reason why there's so much tiredness in the world. I think every time I go to a cocktail party and someone says, well, what do you do? And I say, I'm a sleep medicine doc. And every single time the person says, oh my gosh, I so need to talk to you. So sleep problems are pervasive. In the case of sleep apnea, especially, it's a blind spot in your life. You need a test to figure out if it's present or not.
Interesting. Okay. Let's talk about that in a minute. But why the gap in genders? That's very interesting to me. It's not a vast gap, but still a difference. Is it speculation or can you answer what's the difference?
Yeah. So this is a complicated question. And let me start by saying that once a woman goes through menopause, the risk for sleep apnea is equivalent to that of men. And this is because estrogen and especially progesterone are respiratory stimulants, okay? So you might think about, you know, when a woman is carrying a baby in the uterus and that baby gets big, big, big and starts pressing up on the base of the lungs, The woman has to have that respiratory drive to keep breathing, even in the face of that pressure. Whereas a guy can grow a big beer belly and not have that drive, okay? So premenopause, women are actually a little bit protected from sleep apnea. However, that just means that they're less likely to drop their blood oxygen levels. They can still wake up from sleep briefly, not into their awareness, but just a brief arousal from sleep because they've blocked off their airway a bit. Now, we're not terribly good at measuring this. And for any woman listening, having a home sleep apnea test may not be sensitive enough for a woman's sleep apnea. And that's because one whole type of breathing event is not counted in a home test. So the home sleep apnea test may not be sensitive to pick up the sleep apnea, and that's why I like to call it inconclusive instead of a negative test.
When I was at a conference last year, Dr. Kevin Stock, he's a dentist, but he's dealt with sleep apnea as well. From the dental side of things, he talks about malocclusion and breathing issues as well, fatty tongue, and all those things. We did a breath hold exercise, and he started a video, and the video was of a dude at a sleep lab, and we started when he stopped breathing, and he had an apnea, and we all held our breaths for as long as people could hold out. And this apnea, I would say, is probably not even among the more severe as far as length of time, but it was about 36 seconds. So anybody at home, take out your phone and try to go without breathing for 36 seconds. Again, I'm sure apneas can go way longer than that, but that was pretty miserable. I have to say, it was not very comfortable to go that long. I can't even imagine what that does to your brain and the rest of your body when that is happening back to back to back to back multiple times in a day.
Yeah, totally. And, you know, just to kind of piggyback on what you said, in scoring the severity of obstructive sleep apnea, we report something called the AHI, which is the apnea hypopnea index. That's the number of airway obstructions per hour of sleep time. So for example, if you had 60 airway obstructions per hour of sleep time, that's one obstruction per minute. Okay, so just let that fall on you, because one of the analogies I make is that, you know how when your smoke alarm needs a battery change and it'll like go off intermittently? And for me, it always happens at like 2 o'clock in the morning. And it's such a drag.
Of course it does.
Yeah. Well, for somebody with sleep apnea, it's like their smoke alarm is going off in their brain. That's an emergency. Your brain is oxygen deprived. And so it's signaling you to wake up and do something. So if that's happening once a minute, you are not getting good sleep. But here's the kicker. In order to score one airway obstruction, it has to be 10 seconds long. And then there's some recovery breathing after that. If you're having airway obstructions that are 30 or 40 seconds long, you can't have a higher AHI than 60. Because you are not breathing for 40 seconds and then you're taking 20 seconds of recovery breaths and then you don't breathe again for 40 seconds. So some people say like, oh, my AHI was 100. It's terrible. But what I know about that person is that they have short events. There's somebody out there right now who has an AHI of 60 and they have 40-second events. And that person's AHI is more severe because of the length of time they're not breathing.
Interesting. Is there a way to factor that into that score, like the amount of time that each apnea is?
Yeah, this is something that I hope to see change with sleep apnea scoring. So what I'm describing is called the hypoxic burden, because when your airway is blocked, and I literally see this on a sleep study, the pulse oximeter on the finger is just kind of trending down, 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 down. So the number of minutes at or below oxygen level of 88% is one metric that we can use to score severity. That's not incorporated into the AHI currently, but whenever I read a sleep study, I will make a comment about that. Like, this patient spent 1 hour and 20 minutes with blood oxygen levels at or below 88%. This is significant hypoxic burden. Whereas a different person may have the same AHI, So, you know, let's say 60 events per hour, but when their airway blockage only occurs for 10 seconds, their blood oxygen level may only fall to 88, 90% down from 97%, let's say. So they don't have as much hypoxic burden, and you can quantify that, but it's not currently a standard reporting measure.
Got it. Okay. That makes sense too. You mentioned the test. There's an at-home version. You can also go to a lab. I think lots of people have so much aversion to going in the lab, but you said there's also a lot of false positives or false negatives with the at-home test. What's the difference between the two? What are they looking at? And should people have an aversion to going and getting their sleep checked out at a lab?
Yeah, I'll start with the home sleep apnea test. And I say that purposefully because the home sleep apnea test only tests for sleep apnea. It doesn't test for restless leg syndrome. It doesn't test for parasomnia. It doesn't test for anything else, just sleep apnea. Okay. And it's only helpful if it's positive. Again, a negative test really should be called inconclusive. The benefits to a home sleep apnea test are you get to sleep in your own bed. There's fewer sensors. There's no sensors on the scalp, for example. And it's a lot less expensive, quite frankly. And in today's day and age, a lot of people have super high deductibles. So they kind of put off their sleep testing until the end of the year to see if their deductible is used up. Or they just put it off for another year and on and on. So the home sleep apnea test is a sort of a quick screening measure. Helpful if it's positive. If it's negative, even though the person has symptoms, I would give that major side eye. The in-lab sleep study is sort of the gold standard for sleep apnea testing, also for sleep testing. And I could objectively see if somebody is awake or asleep, whereas the home sleep apnea test is just giving an educated guess. So kind of weird, but the home sleep apnea test doesn't actually measure sleep. It only gives a guess at the sleep, and the guess is maybe 70% accurate. An in-lab test can test for a bunch of other things. It is more involved. There's more sensors applied to the body. It's a little bit weird sleeping, you know, away from your bed, and there's a sleep technician, and it's a vulnerable place to be. But here's where I think expectations can be managed better. People think that they have to have a typical night's sleep or a representative night's sleep when they do the in-lab sleep study. And I'm here to tell you, do not expect that. This is going to be a weird thing that you go through, and it will make an impression on you. And when you start talking about it, you'll find a friend who had the same experience. But when I look at the sleep test, I can factor out all of the wakefulness because the sensors on your scalp are telling me objectively when you're asleep or awake. And I can just look at the sleep, and usually there's more than enough sleep to make a good diagnosis. So the in-lab test has the advantage of being more accurate, testing for more sleep disorders. And again, especially for women, this is important when sleep apnea is on the table.
Got it. Okay. Really important. And again, part of people's expectation, I think, is that they're going to do the sleep lab and they're going to come home with a CPAP. And I have to give you a lot of credit because you really changed my mind about this topic when you were talking on the Stay Off My Operating Table podcast about it. In the low carbohydrate nutrition space, we have a tendency to look at, you know, things and procedures and medicine as like, this is bad. We shouldn't do this. There should be natural causes. We have that kind of tendency. And you were getting asked that question in the direction of like, the CPAP is kind of stupid, right? And you were like, hold on, like, this is actually like a really, really good thing. And we need this. And you even explained some of the alternatives to a CPAP, and they didn't sound all that great to me. I just think of a CPAP and I see, you know, some of my clients early in the morning still have, you know, the marks from the machine. In my mind, I think it's like loud and noisy and whatever. And that's not necessarily the case. Can you explain why a CPAP is actually not necessarily as bad as people think?
Oh my gosh. Thank you for asking this question. This is something I feel really strongly about. And I've been able to help so many people get past the whole obstacle that they create in their mind about CPAP. So let me give you something that I hear all the time. People would tell me, I just want to sleep normally again. I don't like the mask. I don't like the machine. I don't like the air being forced down my throat. So go back to the statement, I just want to sleep normally again. First point is, you have not been sleeping normally for years. You have sleep apnea. The idea of sleeping normally is a false idea, and it will erode your health if you don't get treated. Second point I want to make is that in the medical delivery system, I never felt like I had enough time to lay out all the alternatives to CPAP treatment that people really wanted to know, because the appointments were like 20 minutes long, if that. And so for anybody who's kind of up against this idea of what should I do to treat my obstructive sleep apnea, I created a whole video library of 21 plus CPAP alternatives, because this is everything I wanted people to have access to as they made the decision for themselves. That's important. It's important to feel empowered and like you have a direction that you choose. I think when people are using CPAP and they feel like it's forced on them or against their will, that is not compatible with sleep. And so either you change your mind and choose CPAP, or you empower yourself with knowledge and you make a choice in a different direction. My wish is that everybody just treat their sleep apnea in a way that makes sense for them. So I really encourage people to just treat it. Don't make the mistake of thinking like you're never going to sleep normally again, because you're going to move toward a new normal.
Perfect. And so that means that if you're working on other things and you're improving sleep in other ways, a CPAP that you're using today will definitely help you breathe better. And there's a future where you could potentially be done with this and sleeping, I guess, quote unquote, like more normally. That's the potential.
Yeah. I mean, I define normal sleep as you're sleeping enough so you feel alert and awake during the day. You're cycling through the different sleep stages appropriately, and your blood oxygen level is normal the whole night. You need that to sleep normally. When you have, you know, no mask and your sleep apnea is going untreated, you're fooling yourself. You're not sleeping normally at all.
Okay, excellent. Well, let's start to talk a little bit about the ways that we can improve our sleep. And I want to start with things like medications and supplements. You hear a lot about these. The stories about Ambien would be funny if they weren't so serious. Where are we? State of the state. Let's start with medications. Where are we with medications? Do we have viable options that really truly help people sleep better by taking a pharmaceutical?
Yeah. So Ambien is historically like the go-to for sleep problems. And unfortunately, you know, the effects are subtle. Ambien has, you know, will get you between 20 and 40 minutes of extra sleep. And long-term use of Ambien not only makes you tolerant of the medication, so you're dependent on it, but you don't necessarily get the benefit over time, but also it's associated with some cognitive decline with chronic use. And so I think you're really shooting yourself in the foot if you decide to use Ambien as a crutch. It's really meant for short-term periods like, you know, death of a spouse or some work stress or whatever, and then even only intermittently. So Ambien was never intended to be a chronic sleep aid. My whole stance is people should develop skills, not pills. And anything that you're putting in your mouth to improve your sleep, that includes pills, gummies, alcohol, and, you know, sleep supplements from your favorite Vita store or whatever, those things are not really backed up by a whole lot of data, especially the supplements. And, you know, I am not here to yuck anybody else's yum, but my first priority is always to make sure that that supplement is safe. And I'll give you an example. Most of the time, people are really like, saying, oh, I want to try this melatonin at this dosage. Maybe I'll try this different brand at that dosage. So there's been two studies now. So these are peer-reviewed scientific papers looking at a selection of 20 plus melatonin preparations just picked up out of a store. And what was found was that there was between 0 and 478% melatonin active ingredient compared to what was written on the bottle. So melatonin dosing is really tricky. If you're getting melatonin above 5 milligrams and above, you're probably just peeing it out. It's not working for you. and you might be getting 478% of what's on the bottle, and you might be getting nothing. Even more disturbing, I think, is that some of the preparations were found to be contaminated with serotonin and contaminated with CBD. And most people are like, eh, CBD, who cares? But I'm here to tell you that parents give melatonin to their children. And when you think of children getting ingested CBD, that might change your story a little bit. The truth is that there's a strong placebo effect when it comes to sleep supplements and sleep aids, such that people love the idea of being able to pop a pill and having reliable sleep. Like, that pairing is really seductive. So if there's no harm, fine. Keep doing your placebo. I think that's fine. But just make sure it's not harming you. Make sure it's not interacting with other medications. Make sure that you don't have a psychological dependence on it. And usually that's what people experience.
That's a huge percentage in variance. That's crazy.
Totally.
Wow. And knowing that supplements are unregulated, you really truly don't know what's coming in the box unless they're third-party tested and you found a good brand that you like. Yeah, my company used to sell supplements all the time. So we'd push these on people. And I remember when we started selling melatonin, and I believe it was 3 grams, and I tried... milligrams? Do they come in grams or milligrams?
Milligrams. Okay. Yep.
And I remember hearing this, and this was certainly true for me, that if you didn't take enough, you'd have like really kind of like shallow sleep. And if you took too much, you'd be totally groggy in the morning. So I remember taking it for maybe like 5 or 6 days and being like, I do not like the way that I feel on this stuff. Not great.
Yeah. And you know, I when people say, you know, I really want to try a supplement, or here's a supplement I've been trying, I'll give you some tips for how to like make that a little bit rigorous. So if given the chance, you should do a single ingredient preparation. Some of these like sleeping supplements have 40 different ingredients or 5 different ingredients. Who knows what that stuff is doing, and who knows what it's been contaminated with during the manufacturing process. So try a single ingredient preparation. Literally write down what you are hoping to get out of this medication, and take it, no joke, take it nightly for at least 2 weeks, preferably 4 weeks. After that time period, look back at your notes and see if you got that effect. People have this thing called recency bias. We talked about confirmation bias. There's also recency bias, which means if you have kind of been taking a supplement for a while and you wake up after a good night's sleep, your confirmation bias will say, oh, it's the sleep supplement. That's money well spent. But if you wake up after a bad night's sleep, you'll say, oh, that supplement may not be working, or maybe I'll try this and add something on. Like, it's a mess, right? So make it a little bit scientific by creating a rigor to your taking the medication. Write down your symptoms that you want to treat. 2 to 4 weeks later, look back and see if it's working for you.
That is a great idea. That's great advice. I love that. I love that you said earlier too, that we're trying to build a skill, not necessarily use pills. And that to me is also very empowering, right? You can practice this stuff. You can get better at this stuff. So talking about the skill building of sleep, what skills can we learn to achieve better sleep? And maybe why don't we start with that question during more of like the daytime, morning to like afternoon time? What things can we be doing when we wake up to be able to set up better sleep later on down the road?
Love it. And you know, the subtext here is that sleep and wake are happening all day long. So you've probably heard of the circadian rhythm. There's also an ultradian rhythm. So about every 90 minutes, we go through a period of focus and then unfocus. And you know, the same thing carries in our evening times with sleep cycles and stages, et cetera. When we first wake up in the morning, and I want to start here deliberately, because your wake up time is key. You want to hold your wake up time consistent 7 days a week. Now, this is like so super unsexy, right? This is like the equivalent of saying eat your vegetables. But it's such a basic tenet of sleep health that I really want to underscore the idea that you give your brain a way to pivot from sleep to wake more efficiently. And so you kind of release all the morning grogginess, and when it kind of takes you like an hour and a half to get up and going. No, that's so inefficient. Hold your wake up time the same time, or at least within a half an hour or so, and get up and get going at the same time. Get bright light in your eyes. That what that does is it sets a timer in your brain such that 16 hours later, you're going to be more prepared for sleep. And that's really important. Light is by far the most important signal for awakeness. And I'd like to kind of point out that your brain, which is the thing that sleeps, is in your skull, which is dark. Your eyes are the windows, so you have to let the light in to tell the brain it's time to be awake. After you get that bright light, if you can couple it with exercise, that's another signal for wakefulness. If you can regulate your meal timings, that's a signal for wakefulness. And even if you can make a smallish feeding window or mealtime window, that is going to help your brain understand that digestion and awake are paired and sleep and fasting are paired. So that's one way that you have that bi-directional movement between sleep and food. At nighttime, you're going to let go of the electronic screens, preferably 2 hours before bed. An hour at least would be better. And it's not just the light that's a problem. The short wavelength blue light in any handheld device is going to give your brain that mixed signal. But there's also an emotional component when we are scrolling social media or we're trying to answer emails or deal with those loose ends at work. You know, all of these things kind of stir us up in a way that's incompatible with sleep. So your bedtime routine is really important. I imagine yours is really tuned in and allows you to kind of land the plane at the end of the day. Can you tell me more about it?
I would like to think that. Probably not as good as as it should be. Yeah, I mean, I've learned things like, you know, the few seasons that I was watching The Walking Dead, like not a great idea to watch The Walking Dead right before bed and then have, you know, zombie nightmares all night. Yeah. I found the thing I wish people would understand is to take what you're saying and be more pragmatic about these kinds of things. So people will say like, yeah, get outside. That sounds awesome, but I either work from home or I have to drive to the office. I drive in the dark, so I never get daylight there. Then I go to my office building and I sit in my office and I drive home at night. And then the only light you're getting is Netflix at night. There's things I wish people would understand that they could try to do to be a little bit more pragmatic. So like walking meetings, mm-hmm. for example, like my managers and I, when we had meetings, we would sit in an office and I was like, you know, it's a beautiful day outside. Why don't we go out, do this same thing? We're side by side, which energetically feels like I'm working through problems with somebody versus being confrontational on the other side of a desk. And now we're in the sunshine and now we're getting that big bright light. And you can take calls and meetings and do things outside during the day when it's nice weather and you can get that sunlight. And then on the other side at night, you know, I really do try to have my electronics off at a certain time. I use a sauna. For me, sitting in the sauna for 30 minutes really, really helps my sleep. I wonder if that's a temperature regulation kind of thing, if that helps my body temperature come down and that's what's helping the most. And I do try to protect that. But if I am going to turn on a screen, I make sure that I have pretty strong blue light blocking glasses. Probably not the best, but it's, again, it's a step. I also think doing things like changing the settings on your phone to really have that filter kick in at sunset and be like really strong. So there you go. Exactly. Yep. That screen is so orange. It kills all the blue light. Again, is that the very best thing ever? Probably not, but it's a step in the right direction that helps us kind of like how we evolved meets where we are today and the reality of our situation in 2024.
Totally. And you know, that perfectionistic black and white thinking is something that keeps people stuck. And it really comes out when you're sleep deprived. So, you know, anybody who is dealing with ongoing chronic mild sleep deprivation is going to have problems with their flexibility in thinking. I'll tell you that as you were talking, I wanted to point out, I'm living up here in Minnesota, which is a very high latitude. So during the winter, you know, in my mind, we have like 2 hours of daylight, but you know, it's not that bad. But the truth is, I am very sensitive to light. I think that's part of my genetics. It's not just because I'm a sleep nerd. And I get artificial light. So on my website, there's a store of products that I like. And I'll mention two that'll help with this practical problem of light in the morning. So one, which is very affordable, is a light box that's about the size of a tablet. It's rechargeable. It allows you to adjust the light up or down, warm or cool, whatever. I love it. And it's something that you can use when you first wake up in the morning to give yourself that boost of awakeness and help to transition your brain from sleeping to being alert. The other one is more spendy. It's a product called AYO, which is A-Y-O. And I don't have them here. I think they're on the charger. But it's like they look like glasses, except there's no lens. There's a blue light that's sort of sitting on top of the upper frame. And that light is coming at you from your upper visual fields, which may be important in receiving that light optimally. So you can put these glasses on, and I'll do it in the morning as I'm eating breakfast or looking at my computer. Put them on for 20 minutes. They actually shut off when 20 minutes is over. And that gives me a dose of light, and I can get up and move around as I'm getting that light exposure. So there's ways around these problems, but when you're sleep deprived, your brain doesn't want to think too hard, and so it won't go after those creative solutions.
Those are great solutions. I love the light box. I've been looking into that one. I do a lot of weird stuff. I will like totally admit I'm the weirdo who's walking around the neighborhood barefoot with my shirt off, and I do a lot of weird things. And so I accept that. That's fine. This one, even for me, seemed a little bit weird, but I saw an offer for a 90-day guaranteed. You can try this thing. I'm like, okay, I'll give it a whirl. Grounding. I do grounding. Like I said, I try to get connected to the earth. I'm sitting on a grounding mat as we speak. And this is a sheet that goes over the bed that plugs into the grounding hole of your outlet. So there's no electricity running through it. It's just if your house is connected properly to the earth, there is grounding. And I set this up and I plugged it in, and I cannot believe that I'm getting amazing sleep. And the only exception to that was when I found out after a few nights of not so great sleep that the thing had come unplugged, plugged it back in, and got great sleep again. I've never heard you talk about this, so I don't know if you have any anecdote around it, but any thoughts on that?
Yeah, you know, I've learned to just really take things like this with an open mind. And again, my stance is always to make sure there's no negative effects, first of all. That's the first principle of medicine, first do no harm. So this grounding thing, I've never heard of, but I can tell you that there's some cutting edge development in processing sound and helping to regulate brain waves that way. There's also pulsed electromagnetic fields that are being tested out to improve sleep quality. There's infrared light that's potentially a source of benefit. My scientific brain gives everything side eye until it's been through a rigorous study. Now, you and I both know there's research, and then there's research, you know, and the research that I respect is the one that's in a high impact scientific journal, has been peer reviewed by people in the field, and shows a study population with a, you know, really respectable crossover design or a randomized trial or something that's super scientific and not just like the company itself sponsored a group of 30 people on their email list to take this supplement, and 30 out of 30 said it was fantastic.
Amazing.
You know, I just, yeah. And you know, does that fall under the category research? Yeah, for a lot of people it does. And, you know, that person's going to be on TikTok with 500,000 followers, and, you know, and on we go. So until I can like understand the mechanism and connect all the dots, I'm not ready to recommend a product like that. However, you know, in any research study, one of the limitations is you take this group of people, right? And there may or may not be an effect when you do all the stats for that group. But some people in that group are going to get massive benefit. And maybe we don't understand why that is. Do we need to? I don't know. But I need to make sure that they're not harmed. That for sure I can get behind. So does the grounding work? I don't think I could put that together in my mind. But as long as you're not getting electrocuted, I think you're okay.
There was a warning that was like, when you're sitting on this, like, don't play with like a laptop or something that is plugged in. You'll feel like it'll be unpleasant. It'll just buzz. Like it's not going to kill you, but like, it's uncomfortable. So we don't recommend that. So anyway, I really appreciate that very, very thoughtful answer. I love that you mentioned, you know, circadian rhythms and timing as related to food and nutrition. I think intermittent fasting, time-restricted eating, whatever you like to call it, regardless of what your diet is, I think is a wonderful thing that you just kind of crunch in when you're taking in your calories, and you have the rest of the time where you're not taking in calories, whatever those calories look like. I think that's wonderful. You already mentioned exercise. Is there a type of exercise that you like? And I think I know where you're going to go with this, but there's also got to be a timing aspect to that as well.
There can be. I'm a lot less strict than this about this than I used to be because, you know, I've met people that can work up a sweat even pretty late at night and get to sleep. And I'm a big believer in exercise. I think exercise boosts your mood, improves your self-efficacy. And if you are somebody who wants to age well, you need to maintain your muscle mass, full stop. So if you are going to get exercise in the afternoon or evening, go for it. You can manage the effects on your sleep if you need to. And there's two things to try. Now, you mentioned your sauna, which I wanted to circle back to anyway. So the reduction in core body temperature that occurs naturally at night is a signal for sleep. You can accentuate that in a sauna or in a warm to hot bath. Because what happens is when you are in that environment, all of the small blood vessels in your arms and legs and hands and feet open up. Then when you get out, they all kind of act as a heat sink and let all of that heat out into the atmosphere. And so your core body temperature goes down a little bit. And if you're somebody that exercises at night, that may be happening naturally as you increase your core body temperature and dilate the capillaries in your extremities. If it's not happening, then you can try taking a cool shower to reduce your core body temperature or at least accentuate that natural drop and get to sleep. Exercise is great for better sleep quality. And I kind of make this analogy with a pendulum. If you are exercising, getting your heart rate up and like engaging your big muscles and everything, you're pulling that pendulum back. And then at night, it'll swing further in the direction of good, healthy sleep. If you're somebody who's sedentary, you're barely picking that pendulum up so that your sleep is not as good as it could be. The truth is, there's no such thing as a healthy, sedentary person. So everyone should exercise.
I absolutely love that answer. And I want to point out to the listener, when you just rattled off a bunch of different benefits of exercise, not one time did I hear you say the benefit of exercise is to be really skinny or to lose weight. You named so many amazing benefits of exercise, cognition, sleep improvement, longevity, that had nothing to do with weight control and being skinny. I think it just goes to show what we know now about exercise. If you would have asked me maybe 5 years ago, I would have said like, yeah, maybe you get a little bit of side benefit of those things. But now we know about exercise, it's like, it is so much better for the brain than we all once assumed. I think that's wonderful.
Totally. And I'll tell you something that was useful about my obesity medicine fellowship. I learned, and there's a lot of data to support this. If you're somebody who wants to lose weight, 90 to 95% of your weight loss success can be traced back to nutrition. Only 5 to 10% is related to exercise. And if you are somebody who wants to maintain weight loss, you need to lean into the exercise big time. You want to preserve that lean muscle mass. You want to enhance that metabolically active tissue. And that's where your maintenance comes in. But for weight loss, focus on the nutrition.
Thank you so very much. I'll never forget this one. I worked on a metabolic cart for over 10 years, so I got to measure this, and I had the fortune of measuring somebody who just got kicked off the Biggest Loser contest, and she was telling us horror stories of how bad it really is, like 1,200 calorie diets, and it was like 6 hours a day of the trainers just like yelling at them, and I measured her metabolic rate. After she got kicked off, it was 1,000 calories less than what it should have been. Just completely destroyed her metabolism by following that kind of old advice. This has been a very comprehensive episode all about sleep. Is there anything we missed or anything you'd like to highlight?
You know, I think one of the things I'm finding more and more are, you know, just the connection between healthy sleep and dementia, I think deserves worth mentioning. And, you know, there's an exercise element there too. This is something that I'm talking a lot about because as I meet more women who are going through menopause and even men who are kind of confronting their morbidity and mortality in their own way, they're realizing that, you know, the heart attack that kills them isn't what they're afraid of. They're afraid of the losing their mind. They're afraid of accumulating medical problems that make them dependent on others and take away their quality of life. And I'm here to tell you that when it comes to dementia, 70 to 80% of it can be controlled by lifestyle. So your risk is reduced by lifestyle. And you can age in health if you get your priorities straight, protect your sleep, protect your nutrition, protect your exercise. And I think there's something to be said for mood and mental health as well. But you know, everybody wants to age well. And as our population is living longer, I think this is more and more important.
Yep. I love that. What a great way to conclude this conversation. Dr. Wells, where would you like people go to find you and connect with you and your work?
Yeah, thanks. I have a website called supersleepmd.com. And through this website, I help people with obstructive sleep apnea and insomnia. I help them to get fully treated without sacrificing sleep or comfort. And then I do some limited one-on-one coaching for high achievers at my website, awellsmd.com. I do have some one-on-one appointments, and you can certainly find my schedule through either of those websites.
That is fantastic. We will link that in the show notes. I just have to say, like, for your history, being a doctor and being frustrated that you're only seeing for people for 20 minutes at a time and not able to communicate the information that you wanted to, I have so much respect for what you've decided to do with your career and how you've helped people, not only in individual settings, but also in group settings, and the amazing Facebook page that you have where there's a community around this and people talking about this. And I find those to be so helpful for people. And I have a lot of respect for somebody like you that's gone out to do that to really, truly help people. So Dr. Audrey Wells, thank you so very much for all of your work. Thank you for sharing your vast knowledge on this topic with us today. I think the listener will come away with a lot of really great practical information. And thank you for spending time with us today. We really appreciate you.
I had a great time, Casey, and I found your questions to be super thoughtful. So thanks for sharing some of your personal experiences as well.
Well, thank you. I think your responses were equally thoughtful. So really appreciate you for that. Thank you so much. And this has been another episode of Boundless Body Radio. As always, thank you so very much for listening to Boundless Body Radio. Hosting this podcast is seriously one of the most meaningful and joyous parts of my life. Even after 600 episodes of our show, I still get nervous before every interview that I do. But it does just bring me such joy to share some of my favorite people, the people that have taught me so much over the years, and to invite them on and ask them questions, and then to share that with you, the listener, is a super cool experience. I hope you've enjoyed the content of the show so far this year. I tried to start the year off with a mix of new guests and returning guests, some that are practically household names in the health and wellness space, and some inspiring people that may not be very well known now, but are certainly doing amazing work wherever they are. I'm just so grateful for all of our incredible guests. Remember that you can always go to our website to book a complimentary 30-minute session with us at myboundlessbody.com. On our homepage, one of the first things you'll see is a Book Now button where you can select a time to speak with us about your personal health and fitness plan. We don't have any set packages, products, supplements, or anything like that to sell you. People that do want to work with us simply pay for the time that they want, and that's about it. We've loved chatting with so many of you out there to bounce ideas off each other and try to offer any advice that we can. And seriously, as always, even if you book a spot just to say hello and introduce yourself, we absolutely love connecting with you, the listener, and our community. Be sure to check out our YouTube channel, which is also growing quite a bit, if you want to watch these full interviews and also shorter videos on more specific topics taken from these interviews as well. It's a fun way to interact with people who comment. We read and reply to every single YouTube comment we get, so be sure to subscribe to our channel and leave as many comments as you like. And of course, if you haven't already, please leave us a 5-star rating and review on Apple. It is still the best way to make sure that the podcast gets out to more listeners. It only takes a moment to leave a review, and it's extremely meaningful to us. Cheers, and thank you again for listening to Boundless Body Radio.